got going on Thursday morning besides? So let's get Merriman out of here.
I didn't know you were wrong.
Good morning. I'd like to convene the House Committee on Business and Labor and start out with a public hearing on House Bill 3304. Jan, give us a description, please.
Chair and committee members, I'm going to tell you about the Dash 2 amendment to this measure because it replaces the measure, and it's from the sponsor. The Dash 2 amendment allows the person applying for a landscape construction professional license to satisfy the examination requirement by either passing a written examination or passing a skills test and attending a business practices class. It requires the Landscape Contractors Board to offer the practical skills test as frequently as they offer the written examination, and it requires the board to report to the Legislative Assembly by September 15, 2016, regarding the implementation of the skills test. Declares an emergency effective on passage.
Shall we have Representative Hurd come up? And Representative Nierman, it's your choice whether you want to join him or not. Good morning. If you introduce yourself for the record, please.
State Representative Dallas Hurd, House District 2. So, thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. This is my first bill that I'll be testifying on, so I'm slightly nervous, as you can imagine. I am here today supporting the Dash 2 Amendment to House Bill 3304. The main reason I put this bill together, the Dash 2, was that I am a licensed landscape contractor. I've had a lot of experience in this industry over the last several years with perfecting my craft. I can say that when I first started out, passed the test, got my license and whatnot, I wasn't near the contractor that I am today as far as my skills, my ability to see the future landscape and complete it. And so, but I can tell you that the test was extremely difficult for me to pass, and I know it's very difficult for a lot of folks. In my local community, last time I checked, I don't believe there's anybody that's actually operating a legitimate licensed landscaping company in Douglas County, the business, everything all put together, that's under 45. And so to me, that says that we've got a process that is it's nice. Slightly too restrictive. And so my hopes are that we will help people that, in my experience, I've seen to be, in a lot of cases, the most impoverished of us. I mean, I can tell you, when I first started landscaping, I could barely afford a small use tractor. And now, in just a few years, we've grown the business quite a bit to where we've got a lot of nice equipment, and we're able to do much more. My whole intent with this bill is to just simply give people the opportunity to pursue the American dream. It really is something I get quite emotional about sometimes. I won't do that to you today. But I've just seen so many people struggling, working under the table, working non-licensed, doing a lot of things that they normally would prefer to do differently if they could just pass the test and get their license and become compliant, because I haven't met anybody yet that doesn't want the license. They just don't feel like they've got the means or sometimes the education to actually complete it. There's members of the Landscape Contractors Board sitting behind me, and I wish I had the answer to this, but I don't believe, and they can correct me if I'm wrong, I don't believe the test currently is offered in Spanish. And so there's obviously a big problem there, that if an individual can't speak English or read English, it pretty much completely eliminates them from the possibility of compliance. And so the whole point of this bill is to simply work with other professionals to come up with a real-world test, similar to a driving test when you're getting your driving license. I think most of us would admit that simply the written test does not prove you're a good driver. That's why we have the driving test. And I would say that relates to this as well. And so I'm hoping we can, with this legislation, come up with something that will make it to where we have a lot more people that are now compliant with the law. Because the fact of the matter is, if you're not licensed and you're doing something wrong, and you get into a conflict with a customer, the Landscape Contractors Board has no authority because you're not licensed. And so let's help bring people out of the shadows, Let's help people be able to actually advertise their services, because I've said it many times in offline conversations that there could literally be somebody out there that cannot read or write that may be the best landscape contractor out there. They may have the best equipment operating skills, the best people managing skills, the best creative mind to actually start and complete these kinds of projects and do an amazing job for their customers at a great price that may not be available out there in the market right now. But just because they simply don't have the education to do a written test, they'll never have the opportunity to pursue the American dream. So that's simply all I'm trying to achieve here for those folks that really can't speak for themselves.
Thank you. Representative Nierman,
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Mike Nierman. I'm the state representative from House District 23, and I'm not a landscape contractor. And if you drove by my house today, you would agree with me that I'm not a landscape contractor. my yard work there. And I don't have much more to say to add to what my colleague said. The one thing I'll say is a quote from one of my constituents who is a landscape contractor and who brought the original bill to me. He gave me a big, long speech and then summarized by saying, you don't need to know the Latin names for plants to be able to lay sod and move boulders. And so I agree with my colleague that this is a great way to extend opportunities to other people, and I appreciate the opportunity to testify.
Thank you. Questions?
Yeah.
Representative Kittimer.
Let's see, you have another chief sponsor, is that correct?
Yeah, I don't see him listed on OLIS yet, but Representative Brad Witt is intending to be a co-chief sponsor.
Okay, thank you.
What?
Just joking. Yeah.
Other questions? Representative Barreto.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. One of the things in here, you know, that seems that you would be alluding to in someone that didn't speak English. I'm wondering how that works with contracting with those people that want a job done, just as far as reading the contract. When you do a job, do you sign a contract with the owner saying this is the plan that I've drawn up, this is what it'll take, this is either how much it'll cost or approximate? So in doing that, how would you work through the language barrier then as far as setting up a contract with someone if they don't speak English?
So in this bill, you'll find that in the landscape the landscape business side of the license, because there's two, to just summarize it, there's basically two parts of the license. You have the licensed professional, so that professional can have a license and they can go work for somebody who has the business license of it. But without the business license side, they can't be what's called, I believe, an all-phase licensed landscape construction company all themselves. So there's the business license side of that. And I wanted to make that a class, an informational class that the state puts together, either themselves, the board, or through a subcontractor that company that might put it together for them, where we educate these individuals on what state law and regulations are. Because I found that the tests, you know, if you take it enough times, eventually you'll probably pass it because you'll just become familiar with the questions, but it doesn't really prove that you know what you're doing. And so that's why I feel education is better than the test in this particular circumstance, because there is a lot of regulations involving this stuff. You have to have there's a common misconception out there with a lot of folks that are in my industry or people that want to be in my industry, that if you do a job for a customer that's $500 or less, you don't have to have a contract. Well, I found that that's not true. Any dollar amount, you have to have a contract. And so that's just one example of where that educational class that I'd like to see become an option to the written test then is for those folks like you referenced that may have language barriers, reading barriers and whatnot, and help them understand the regulations. And then at that point, they're going to obviously need to come up with they're going to have to find an employee or a family member or somebody that can help bridge that communication gap and get that resolved. Does that answer your question?
Other questions?
Maybe just another one, Mr. Chair.
Representative Kinnemer.
It strikes me your bill's a little unusual in that, if I understand it correctly, you're encouraging a lot more competition.
With myself?
Yes.
Yeah. Well,
that's a novel approach, and most people are wishing they had a little less competition, and that's probably although philosophically a lot of us think competition's great, but personally it's a little tougher. And I find this bill kind of intriguing, and I wanted to understand your motivation.
That's a great question and point. This was actually something that I ran on in my election or my campaign, where, and it didn't have to specifically be just about my industry, but it was the fact that I'm not afraid of competition. Because I create the best product, best price, best service. And so regardless of whether I have 10 competitors or 1,000, I believe I'll win if I continue to pursue that, those goals. Furthermore, a free market economy, any economy for that matter, if it's going to be robust and productive, we need everybody working. We first need access to our natural resources, and then we've got to be allowed to go out and do something with them. That's what grows the pie, creates wealth. If we only have 5 people working in the state of Oregon, nobody's going to be rich. Nobody's going to be able to pay their bills, period. And so this is my effort, regardless of how this impacts me in the short term, I'm confident that it will benefit everybody. And then the customers will have a much bigger menu to choose from for bids. Everybody that's in this room will have 10 times eventually the people, I believe, to actually choose from for their landscape construction. You're going to have much more creative design out there because, again, competition is like iron sharpening iron. It's going to make everybody better. And in the end, I do believe it will grow the economy, which indirectly, but that's not my intent, will benefit me somewhere down the line, because a successful economy can only be a good thing for me. And finally, it's for the future generation. I spoke of earlier about how I'm, to my knowledge, the only individual under 45, I believe, in my entire county of 100,000 people that is actually a legitimate licensed landscape construction business operating in the Roseburg, Douglas County District 2 area. That tells me that we have way too restrictive of a process to actually plant rhododendrons. And so, I think this is a great bill. I have heard very little opposition. In fact, the only opposition I've had emailed to me thus far was that I wasn't going far enough to deregulate or to make options and whatnot. So I believe this is a good bill.
So, Representative Widener.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Nierman, do you think this could lead to illegal mining of aggregate and stealing of big boulders to put in people's yards?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Widener. No.
Representative Escobar, you have a real question?
Yes, I do, actually.
Thank you,
Mr. Chair. I have a legitimate question. Actually, it's not a question. What I'm interpreting here is the same thing I have in my profession of the realtor, mm-hmm. that they teach you the rules, but they don't teach you how to landscape. In real estate, they teach you the rules. They just don't teach you how to be a realtor. Am I correct on that?
You mean as far as the current situation?
Correct.
The fact of the matter is, passing the test does not make you a landscaper.
Yeah,
I would say that this test will prove to be a much more adequate way of showing proficiency. If I may, Mr. Chair, can I respond to Representative Widener's?
No.
We would prefer not.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I didn't you did us all a favor.
So,
I object. Don't let him do it.
So I don't want to be the only one that pushes back a little bit on this concept. I've been in this building a long time, and I remember years ago the industry was coming forward because consumer complaints about people out there doing landscape work and causing damage and, just taking advantage of people. And, so I think they had some good reasons to come in and try to provide some professionalism to the industry.
Yep.
And so I sort of see this as stepping back from that. And I don't really know how rigorous the test is. Certainly it shouldn't be so rigorous that it excludes people. People should be able to pass a test to get it. I just hesitate a little bit because as Representative Esquivel would probably know, you know, if we allowed realtors in without a test at all and just, you know, hope that because they were good at it that they would, you know, excel and competition would take care of the marketplace, it certainly leaves the consumer at some risk. And so I'll be interested to, I know the Landscape Contractors Board is here and some, the association has, you know, not weighed in on the Dash 2 as of yet, so I encourage you to have a conversation with them of perhaps looking at how rigorous the test is itself. Yeah. I hesitate to do away with it.
We're not.
Well, I know, but doing a skills test or a written test with the education training is a novel idea. I'm not saying that it's not a workable, potentially workable situation. I just do have concerns about, you know, the consumer protection element of the business world as well. So,
may I respond to that?
Certainly.
So, great points. You're right. In the past, before I was born, more probably to some degree, is when it was just kind of the Wild West with landscape construction. And I believe at that point it would have been pre-70s when there was no license, maybe pre-75. That is probably not the best way of going about it, which is not what I'm proposing. This is simply an optional test, and I want it to be a thorough, as an option, I want it to be thorough in testing all the different areas that these contractors potentially could dive into. I believe it's going to make it much safer for consumers because there is a high percentage of individuals who are working under the table or in the shadows with no license. What I found really creates accountability is when you now become a licensee, you have to have liability insurance, you have to have a bond, which that protects the consumer. And now you have a number. The Landscape Contractors Board knows who you are and where you are. And so in the back of your mind, if you're not already an honest enough individual that's just going to do it on your own the right way with your consumer or with your customers, now you feel that extra push to do things the right way, because now the LCB can come in if there's a complaint filed against you, and they can regulate you, they can take your license, they can fine you. They can fine you now, but the point is that license is kind of, that's your gold card. That's your ability to advertise. That's your ability to do a lot of things that you can't do when you're not licensed. So I would suggest that it actually will make things much safer and much cleaner for consumers. And then, to the test again. I actually think it's going to be, as somebody who does this for a living and has passed the tests, I believe this would be a much more thorough way of testing proficiency than a paper test.
All right. Thank you very much for bringing the issue forward. It will be an interesting discussion, I think.
Yeah.
And thank you, Representative Nierman, for coming in, too. I appreciate having you here.
Thank you. Nick. I like
that. Up next, Shelley Sneed.
Good morning, Chair Holvey, Vice Chairs Barton and Kennemer, and committee members. My name is Shelley Sneed. I'm the interim administrator of the Landscape Contractors Board, and I'm here today on behalf of the board, which is the agency, as you know, that will be charged with implementing this bill if it passes through the legislative process. So on behalf of the board, I'd like to state that our agency and board is committed to participating in Oregon's legislative process and implementing the laws that are passed by the Oregon legislature. Overall, the agency has a few comments at this point about the Dash 1 amendments of the bill. I'd just like to point out that this process has happened pretty quickly, so our board hasn't had a chance to meet and discuss the bill. They have seen my comments for today. So if we get into a lot of question and answers, I may not have them on behalf of the board today. But first of all, if the hands-on practical skills testing component is included in the final bill, it's likely just to make it clear that the agency will work with a third-party provider. We're a semi-independent for less than 4.5 FTE agency. We don't have the capacity to probably implement this bill internally, but we currently subcontract with a testing provider, so we know how to do that if someone's available to do the work. work. The agency would develop the business practices skills class that's in this version of the bill that would focus on the laws and rules related to the agency in landscaping in Oregon and work with that third-party provider to implement that piece. This version of the bill would maintain our existing qualifications for licensure. And just so everyone knows, we did have very limited qualifications. They're about 2 years ago, they were expanded. So it's very difficult currently for someone to not qualify for licensure in Oregon. This version of the bill, the National Association of Landscape Professionals, which was formerly known as PLANET, has landscape certification programs that allow hands-on testing, which we've talked to Representative Hurd about this option. OLCA, the Oregon Landscape Contractors Association, currently implements the hands-on testing every summer. So it's likely that we would try to work with OLCA. And again, we haven't had a chance to talk to OLCA about their position on the bill or how it may be implemented. But being that that piece already exists, it would be nice to expand on the work that's already there if that's possible. The board appreciates Representative Hurd and Nierman's work on this bill and providing new pathways for licensure in Oregon for those wanting to own and operate licensed landscape contracting business. He mentioned the amount of unlicensed landscaping that's happening and the risk to consumers, and that we will continue to provide input and technical assistance to the committee as you review the bill. Thank you for hearing this today.
Thank you. Questions? So do you think if this bill were to pass that it would do away with the unlicensed people working under the table in the business?
I don't think that, based on my 4 years experience, it's going to do away with it. But what I think it will provide is some of the folks that are unlicensed don't have any idea about the law. And some of them would like to comply, but the examination process is fairly rigorous. We've got some new options, and our staff's getting real adept at communicating those to folks, but passing the exams is challenging. So I think those folks that want to be licensed and have the ability to be patient, because one of the things we talked to Representative Hurd about yesterday is offering hands-on testing as frequently as we do written testing probably isn't a possibility. It's just going to be too cost prohibitive for anyone to do that and have it work for potential licensees. So as long as they're willing and able and can wait till that hands-on testing is available, I think it'll allow folks to comply with the law. I think there's some folks that, as you know, don't want to comply with the law. It's not going to help those folks. But for the ones who would like to, as he mentioned, it absolutely could help with that issue.
Do you anticipate having to, if this bill were to pass, having to raise fees in order to pay for this additional testing?
We haven't even gotten to that piece of the conversation. As you know, this was scheduled, I think, on Monday. So my thought originally, without, again, having talked to OLCA about the possibilities, is that the cost differential would be included in that hands-on testing fee. But again, it's early in the conversation.
And can you tell me what the pass rate is for your written examination?
We have six exams. One of them is based on the laws and rules of the agency, so similar to the Construction Contractors Board exam. That pass rate tends to be higher. The other five exams are technical exams, and their pass rate is between 40% and 60% for first-time test takers. Second-time pass rates tend to be higher.
So you allow people to take the test multiple times?
They can take the test every day until they pass if they like. We used to have a two-week waiting period, and the board has waived that. So now they can test as frequently as they want to go in and test.
And is there a charge for the test?
Absolutely, yes.
Each time they take it?
Yes, but because they take more than one exam, typically there's a higher, the first exam is $65. The additional section on the same day is $10. So if they go in and take three or four exams, it saves them quite a bit of money.
Okay. Other questions for Representative Kinnamer?
Thank you. Is it only in English?
Currently, the exam and study materials are only in English.
And just a comment, if I could, Mr. Chair, you know, I've served on business committee in the Senate, and here this issue has come up quite often. And I think one of my concerns, and something that I don't think got addressed, is that when people are licensed, then we also cover those workers with workers' comp. And I think that's a big issue, because we have a lot of these people working under the table, and it's a difficult thing to regulate, because basically if you've got a vehicle and a shovel, you're potentially in business. On the other hand, if you're not careful, you don't do the right thing about taking care of your employees. And I think that's one of the things that licensed people, their workers are guaranteed that protection and that safeguard. The unlicensed, they're probably in jeopardy, or at least worse if we're not careful.
Representative Esquivel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. How many of these tests do you perform a year? Do you have any idea?
Do you remember? It's been fluctuating because of the recession. The numbers are going up. I don't remember the stats. I can provide those to the committee.
I was just kind of curious if it was 100, 1,000, or what?
It's in the hundreds. It's under 1,000 a year, I believe.
Thank you. I appreciate you coming in and helping us with this bill.
Sure.
Was there anyone else that wanted to testify on House Bill 3304? Not seeing any. We'll close public hearing on House Bill 3304 and open a public hearing on House Bill 3186.
Committee members, this measure deletes language prohibiting the advertising or promotion of outdoor mass gatherings without a permit, clarifies the circumstances when a permanent development may occur on the land where a mass outdoor gathering takes place, declares an emergency, and there are no amendments before you.
Thank you. And do we have anybody signed up to testify today? Glenn Boyd and Elaine Aldridge? Maybe? Maybe it's not Aldridge. Good morning. If you'd introduce yourself for the record before you give us your testimony this morning. Welcome.
Good morning. Chair Hulvey, members of the committee, I'm Elaine Aldridge with Stoll Reeves in Portland, and I'm here to express my support for House Bill 3186. I see it as a simple, narrow fix that's intended to update and clarify an outdated statutory framework regulating outdoor mass gatherings. And just as a little background, outdoor mass gatherings include a variety of different types of activities. In obviously outdoor spaces, they can include music festivals, art festivals, multi-day concerts, other types of festival-type events, similar to the agritourism type activities that are occurring here throughout Oregon. To give you a little background on the regulation of outdoor mass gatherings, the statute that we're here to talk about today is ORS 433-745, which is essentially the meat of the regulatory framework for outdoor mass gatherings. The statutory framework was originally adopted in the 1970s, and it was intended to give local jurisdictions the ability to regulate the when and the how of mass gatherings while ensuring that appropriate health and safety measures were implemented. Over time, there hasn't been many amendments to the statutory framework. The statute before you was originally adopted in 1971 and was amended in 1885, but since then has remained virtually untouched. And so, as you can imagine, it was adopted at a different time than we are in today, when technology was significantly different. Most of everything was in writing or by radio, and when we were just starting to develop our land use regulatory framework. And so there's, as time has progressed, there's been a recognized need to address some of the provisions within this statute, specifically two points. There is a need to update subsection 1 that accounts for the advancement of technology, online media, and the existence of social media in today's world with respect to the prohibition on promoting outdoor mass gatherings prior to a local jurisdiction issuing a permit. Mr. Boyd with Moonshine Events will talk a little more about the practicalities of what it's like to not be able to promote online without holding an actual OMG permit. And the second issue is in subpart 2 of the statute. This is just a clarification, making it clear for both the applicant and the local jurisdictions regulating outdoor mass gatherings that an outdoor mass gathering permit doesn't supersede or replace local land use laws, but that permanent development on a site for an outdoor mass gathering is subject to state and local land use regulations. Just clarifying that an outdoor mass gathering permit authorizes the event itself, whereas if there's permanent development on the property, that either needs to be allowed outright under the existing zoning regulations or it's subject to some permit and review by the local jurisdiction. And so that's just two cleanups, really. I don't view it as changing the substance of the regulatory framework. In no way is the bill intended to undermine the local jurisdiction or its authority to regulate and issue outdoor mass gathering permits. It's simply just time to provide some additional clarification and an update, given that we're seeing an increase in these types of activities in our local communities. I will direct you to the written testimony that was submitted yesterday. Mr. John Roberts, who is the Hood River County Community Development Director and former planning director at Wasco County, submitted written testimony for your consideration. I think it summarizes well the issues that local jurisdictions have been facing and provides some good context for the proposal before you. And so unless there's any questions, I will close.
Go ahead, Mr. Boyd. Do you have testimony?
Yes. Thank you, Chair Holy, members of the committee. My name is W. Glenn Boyd. I'm here representing Moonshine Events. Moonshine produces an arts and music festival out in Wasco County, in the rural section of Wasco County. Every year, we go through a very rigorous process to put together a mass gathering permit. It's very, very involved. It ends up being 25, 30 pages. It's really about talking about the safety and health of the participants who come. What is our fire management plan? What is our medical management plan? What is water management plan? All the various factors. The way the statute is written right now is that we are not allowed to promote or advertise our event until that permit process has been approved at the county level. That process alone is multiple months, and we do this every year. We've already have gone through our fourth year of review. We're coming up on our fourth year of festival. Every year we hit the same concerns and issues, which is we have a website. We also have people who write articles about how great the festival was the prior year. People are constantly throughout the year sending and wanting to know more information about our upcoming festival. Keep in mind, every year it's a new permit. We may get denied if we can't meet the health and safety of the participants, and we understand that. But every year we're in this conundrum of how much can we say legally online without falling and tripping under the fact that we're considered to be promoting a festival, even though the permit process hasn't necessarily happened. And in today's social media, it's easy to unwind. In the event that we lost our permit or didn't obtain it, we can easily send out a message that says the festival has been canceled. In the past, I understand in the 70s, they didn't have that ability to do that. But we're still stuck in this world today. Is like, when is it, are we in violation of this statute, and when are we not, just because of the fact we have a website, or somebody says something on Facebook about how great it was, and they're excited about the new and upcoming event. So we want to see this to help clarify the language so we don't feel like we're in violation during the other 6 months when we're not sitting there with the permit in hand, yet we have a website. And happy to take any questions.
Questions for this panel. Representative Evans.
I have a comment and a question. The comment is, in this day and age, I have a hard time believing that anybody would win in court over something that was or wasn't said on Facebook or in social media or in advertising, given the First Amendment rights that even corporations have right now. So I have a really hard time believing that one. But I understand what you're trying to say, that you don't want to violate the law. Mm-hmm. So here's my question. Is there, in reading this, is there anything else this bill does? Because the concern I have is not about advertising about events, but we have a growing agritourism business in Oregon that is kind of working with land use planning. And what I don't want to see is a situation where there's an explosion of events happening in areas that weren't really designed for them. And then because you build it, they will come, you can't shut things down, and we actually have a little bit of chaos. So I just want your word as a lawyer. This is not opening up Pandora's box.
Chair Holvey and Representative Evans, good question. And really, no, this is all the bill does. This
advertising.
Just the two clarifications. It's I'll talk through both subparts. So the first subpart, if you look at the original language, is you cannot promote, advertise, or otherwise conduct without having a permit. The proposed revisions still keep the statutory framework in the sense that you cannot hold an outdoor mass gathering without having a permit, but it's okay if you advertise and promote it. We have had situations where we have been in court arguing whether someone is violating the statutory provision because they have online media presence. And so that's a problem. And I think, you know, that's just one claim someone has made against a client, right, because they're obviously unhappy with the fact that there's a permit being issued and it's local opposition.
Okay.
It seems so, to be honest, it's so ridiculous that we would have to defend against that kind of claim that it would be better just to clean up the language so that's clear and it's consistent with kind of today's modern media. I definitely support the fact that this in no way changes a local jurisdiction's authority and ability to regulate outdoor mass gatherings.
So,
Just to be transparent, though, with subpart two, there is a minor change there that clarifies that an outdoor mass gathering permit is not intended to approve or deny development, but that authority is vested with the local jurisdiction by way of state and local land use laws.
That this doesn't change?
That doesn't change. Okay. It just clarifies that it really is intended to provide notice saying, hey, any development you're intending to do, better go talk to your local jurisdiction first.
Thank you.
Other questions? Representative Widener.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This one affects my district tremendously. I have a lot of wineries in my district, and this was an issue that we dealt with a long time ago, and it's something that our local commissioners handle in a lot of this event planning. And I'm just looking at, the way I'm seeing this, you could actually almost go out and promote an event before you had the permit for the event. Is that correct?
Chair Holvey and Representative Widener, yes. Mm-hmm.
Could you create a scenario where you have all these people create this event because you're promoting it to where it puts pressure on the local commissioners that they become the bad guys because they didn't approve the conditional use for that one time. So I now you got everybody piling on them.
If you go down a slippery slope, that's a potential possibility. But I think just the reality of today's world with technology, the fact that there is online media presence for any type of activity, changes the framework, and I think that local jurisdictions still have good regulations in place that give them the authority and the discretion to decide whether to approve or deny any type of needed approval. And I think, Mr. Boyd, you'd want to say something.
The only thing I would say is you still have that risk today. People have the power. Well, they used to have the power of the press and the pen. Well, now it's the power of the internet and with blogs and everything else. Sometimes, you know, if somebody wants to start a movement against getting something done at a winery, they're going to do it with or without the promoters it need. I don't think this precludes nor excludes somebody from doing it if they want to do that. I do think that it doesn't change the authority. Like she said, as long as they meet the health and safety and the commissioners want to, you know, deny or approve it, they still have that authority to do that. With today's media, you can unwind something much easier than you could in the past. And the reason these were mostly done in the 70s is that for that very reason, somebody would throw an ad in the paper, say we're having a big mass gathering on Friday, that no way of getting out to all those same people and 8,000 people people show up or whatever it may be. And it became impossible to unwind that kind of thing. So in some ways, the tail was wagging the dog. The producer was throwing these unapproved events, and they were like, well, you know, so they had to put something in place to give the teeth to stop that. And as John Roberts explains in his written testimony, you know, we have dealt with this in Wasco County every year, and it's something that every year we, you know, go through the frustration, and they themselves have dealt with other situations where somebody has tried to promote it without a permit, and they do have the tools to be able to stop that. So I think that it's just, this is just something practical we're dealing with every year, and we'll continue to until the language is clarified.
Other questions for this panel?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Kinnamer.
You know, I realize I probably didn't pay as much attention as I should have, but I am sorry about two previous media accounts in Portland of concern about mass gatherings of protesters without permits and quite an argument about permits. And I didn't follow the outcome. Will this have an impact on the city of Portland in particular?
Chair Holvey and Representative Kinnamer, in my view, no. I think of the outdoor mass gathering framework as separate than some of the issues that are that City of Portland is facing with free speech and gatherings.
Yeah.
And I think that's a different regulatory framework than what we're talking about here today.
If I can, this particular statute deals with mass gatherings that go beyond 24 hours.
Mm-hmm. Ah, so, thank you. That's the piece I was looking for. Thank you.
Okay. Representative Evans.
A comment and a question, or comment and a comment. Don't know where this bill is going to go. If it does, two ideas. One is permit pending might be a good catchphrase to get on everything that happens beforehand, just at the bottom, like drug and other type of things on TV, talk about the side effects. Permit pending might get you out of a little bit of heat. And the second thing is, if I read this right, there are homeless activities, one of which actually also I believe is in Representative Widener's district, where a church has been working with the county to advertise that there's places that they're using as a temporary facility. And if I read this right, currently some of those comments, given the nature of the permit, may actually already be out of sync with what the law is. I'm very grateful for you bringing this up, because I think there's a lot of people that don't know about this law that are acting as if the permit process is separate from what you say in general comments. So thank you.
Thank you. You're welcome. This particular statute also deals with only gatherings of larger than 2,500 people.
3,000
people.
Okay.
So it's a fairly narrow thing. A lot of it most applicable to arts and music festivals that go beyond one day. And that's where we get into it. And the fact is that we have been doing this for multiple years, and we hope to continue to do it for multiple years, and want to be, you know, in between that gray area between the following year has finished and when the next one begins. And how do we do that, you know, and not have to fight this argument every year?
Thank you for bringing it forward.
Yeah.
Representative Widener.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just to follow up, because we have SIP, there's a lot of events that happen in Yamhill County. And we don't have, I mean, our current commissioners handle it quite well. I'm wondering, is there a way you could get a permit where a conditional permit over time? Is there something in law that stops us from doing that? So we plan on doing this for the next 5 years, and then you can just opt out if you don't do it. Is there a way to, I would see that as possibly a better way to go about this?
Chair Holvey and Representative Widener, that is a great idea. And it is actually something we have contemplated and we're considering proposing as a part of this proposed legislative concept. We thought that concept would be too controversial to fix just this kind of prohibition that was presenting some real practical business problems. But long-term, allowing for a multi-year outdoor mass gathering permit would really be a good solution.
Yeah, and that does not exist in any of the framework today. And a lot of the mass gathering or the gatherings that you're referring to are handled at the local levels, are typically below 3,000 people, and they're also not beyond 24 hours. So they have legislation to handle that locally. And this one's that gray area where it's at the state level.
If that was a direction that the committee wanted to continue to explore, I would be happy to be involved in that discussion.
Representative Doherty.
My concern is kind of tagged off of what Representative Widener said, is kind of not for that. We have had situations in Washington County where a property owners had tried to have mass gatherings, and it's been very disruptive for the county and this kind of thing. And you know, not that we want to tie future county commissioners on events and that kind of thing, especially something like this, but I think that the local control is really important on this, and situations change and commissioners change, and so I'm all for this bill. I think it's great. Mm-hmm. but I think that to have something that's a 5 or 6 year a commitment, even the concert promoter may not want that. So. Yeah.
And we understand that. That's why we're not here proposing that right now.
I do also have to make one comment. I'm up here kind of snickering because when you were talking about, well, in the 70s we had no mass media, but I'm telling you, with outdoor concerts, the word got out real fast.
More effective. But there was no way to undo it from a public perspective.
That is true.
Yeah. And you were listening.
And who would want to? Thank you very much for your testimony today. I appreciate it. With that, is there anybody else that wanted to testify on House Bill 3186?
Thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Seeing none, I'll close public hearing on House Bill 3186. Committee, I'm going to just jump out of the order here real quick and see if we can get Mr. Gersonfield back to work. So I'm going to open a work session on House Bill 2440. Jan, can you describe the Dash 2 amendment for us on this bill?
I will, Mr. Chair. The committee heard this measure back in February, and it's a measure that requires a reduction of unemployment insurance benefits to claimants who receive back pay for time during which their benefits were received, and allows a claimant to be eligible for benefits when they are outside of the local labor market for the purpose of applying for employment within their local labor market, declares an emergency. The proposed Dash 2 amendment deletes the proposed change that requires the reduction in the unemployment insurance benefit when the claimant receives back pay award. So the only part left in the bill is the dealing with the ability for the unemployment insurance claimant to travel outside of their labor market for a job interview.
Thank you.
And there is a revenue statement issued on the Dash 2, and there is a minimal fiscal impact on the Dash 2.
Great. Representative Barton, could we have a motion on the Dash 2 for 2440?
Chair Holvey, I move the Dash 2 amendments be adopted into House Bill 2440.
Representative Barton moves the Dash 2 amendments to House Bill 2440. Discussion?
Seeing none.
Is there any objection? Seeing none, the Dash 2 is adopted.
To the floor.
To the floor.
Chair Holvey, I move House Bill 2440 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Barton moves House Bill 2440 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion. Representative Kinnemer.
Mr. Chair, I just want to clarify. So the Dash 2 amendment does not activate the possible repayment of, which was another topic.
That's correct. My committee administrator will confirm that.
The Dash 2 takes out the language that gave the department the ability to recover unemployment benefits paid when somebody receives back pay. That part is removed with the Dash 2 amendment. So the only piece remaining is the ability for the person to continue to receive their benefits when they are traveling outside of their labor market for an interview that occurs, for a job that occurs in their labor market.
Representative Evans.
It appears that Section 2 was taken out, and I look forward in the future to continue work on the discussion points that we took time to try to fix. So just understand the bill needs to move today, but not terribly excited about that piece being taken out.
Yes, thank you. Other discussion? Seeing none, Matthew.
Representative Beretta.
Aye.
Representative Doherty?
Aye.
Representative
Dustin? Aye.
Representative Evans?
Aye.
Representative Fagan?
Yes.
Representative Hurd?
Aye.
Representative
Rose? Aye.
Representative Widener?
Aye.
Vice Chair Barton?
Aye.
Vice Chair Kenmer?
Aye.
Chair Holder?
Aye. House Bill 2440, haven't received the votes, it has passed. Do I have someone excited about carrying this bill?
I'll take it for you.
Okay. Representative Esquivel will carry that bill. I'm going to give you the next one, too. So.
Wait a minute. Time out.
With that, I'll close work session on House Bill 2440 and open a work session on House Bill 3239.
Mr. Chair, committee members, this is the Aggie Bond Bill. It expands the definition of a lender for the purposes of the beginning and expanding farmer loan program to include anyone who sells agricultural land to a beginning farmer, an institution organized under the Federal Farm Credit Act, and any other person or entity defined by the Oregon Business Development Department through rule. Declares an emergency. There are no amendments before you. There's no revenue impact. There's a minimal fiscal impact. And there's no subsequent referral.
Great. No amendments to this bill. We looked at it and vetted it in a few places, determined that we didn't need any amendments. So, Representative Barton, a motion.
Chair Holby, I move House Bill 3239 to the floor with the due pass recommendation.
Representative Barton moves House Bill 3239 to the floor with due pass recommendation. Discussion? Seeing none, Matthew, can we have a vote?
Representative
Breda? Aye.
Representative Doherty?
Aye.
Aye.
Representative Evans?
Aye.
Representative
Fagan? Yes.
Representative
Hurd?
Aye.
Representative
Nost?
Aye.
Representative Weiner?
Aye.
Vice Chair Barton?
Aye.
Vice Chair Kenner?
Aye.
Chair Holby?
Aye. House Bill 3239 never received the votes. It's passed. Representative Esquivel, you'll be carrying this bill.
I would request, Mr. Chair, that I carry this with my esteemed colleague, Representative Clem.
I was going to say, I thought this was
Barton. He's the spark plug.
Okay, we'll do that, too. And if you want to trade off that other bill later, you can do that.
No, I'm good. I'm fine.
Let's make Clem carry the other one, too, while we're at it.
Close the work session, House Bill 3239. And we'll open a public hearing on House Bill 2565.
Mr. Chair and committee members, this measure makes the Oregon State Bar subject to public employee collective bargaining law. There are no amendments before you.
First, let's have John McGovern and Jen Chapman.
Good morning.
Good morning. Welcome to the committee, and just introduce yourself before you start your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is John McGovern. I'm here as a member of the political staff of AFSCME Council 75. I've brought my colleague and the union's legal counsel, Jen Chapman, and she and I can hopefully answer any questions after my testimony. I'm here to comment in support of House Bill 2565. When workers choose to organize and collectively bargain over wages, hours, and working conditions, they do so under the rules as listed under the PECPA or the NLRA. The former is for public employees, and the latter is for the private sector. The Oregon State Bar is a public corporation, so it's subject to several laws that are also applicable to public employers. That includes public records law, public meetings law, and the members of the State Bar can participate in PERS. Currently, the employees of the State Bar are not subject to the PECPA, and therefore they can't organize to collectively bargain as employees of other public corporations can. And that's not to give an exact equivalency to other public corporations, but one example of such a corporation would be OHSU. In addition, these employees at the State Bar are not private sector employees. Therefore, they can't organize under the rules set by the NLRA. So right now, these employees are kind of caught in a gray area where they can't organize under either act. So this bill will allow these employees to have the same rights in regards to collective bargaining granted to other public employees of public corporations by covering them under the PECPA. Employees of the State Bar, it includes lawyers, yet their mission is carried out with the help of several professions. This includes administrative professionals, IT workers, accountants. As a union, we believe workers deserve the right to organize and collectively bargain over wages, hours, and working conditions. And while the state bar is definitely unique in their status as an employer, the employees deserve the right to organize should they choose to do so. So Oregon AFSCME supports the rights of workers to organize in this manner, and we recommend passage of this bill. That's all I have. I wanted to keep it really brief, but my colleague and I hopefully can answer any questions that you might have.
Representative Barton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for coming in. Some vague questions that perhaps you can address, and also I believe the bar is going to come up. Perhaps they can address them as well, or in a supplement or anything of that sort. So as I see this, first of all, I don't have any problem with the intent of this bill at all. Quite to the contrary. Very sympathetic to the intent. I just want to make sure we don't mess something up inadvertently. And when you organize groups of lawyers, it's a little different, I think, because lawyers are also subject to the rules of professional conduct, which inhibits their ability to strike, for example, and other things that might, and I just don't understand. So as I see it, there are a couple different groups here. First of all, there's the state bar. There are the employees, for example, staff. Then there are the lawyers within the state bar. So two groups there. Then I think there's a, I think it's a subset of the state bar, would be the professional liability fund, the PLF, which is essentially a state-run insurance company that all lawyers have to participate in. There's nothing voluntary about it. There's no market choice there. And again, then within the PLF, there are staff, and then there are attorneys. And who the clients are in terms of the two different groups of lawyers at the bar and at the PLF are different. And I just don't know what that means with respect to collective bargaining. Could you guys just allay my fears that we're not going to mess anything up by passing this?
Absolutely. Yeah. Chair Holvey, Representative Barton, again, my name is Jennifer Chapman. I'm legal counsel with Oregon AFSCME Council 75. Currently, there's a wide variety of attorneys that are already organized in the state. We've got Oregon Department of Justice attorneys. We have deputy district attorneys. So there is precedent for dealing with that issue. We've, in fact, got an Oregon State Bar opinion many years ago that addressed the ability of Department of Justice attorneys to go on strike. So there's precedent for this. The other thing I would say is that whether or not the attorneys in the Oregon State Bar would be appropriately combined with the administrative staff would ultimately be a question that would be handled through the Employment Relations Board. Mm-hmm. Because should the employees at the Oregon State Bar want to organize, what they would have to do is they would have to file a petition saying, here's who we want to be in the unit. The Oregon State Bar would then have the ability to object and say, no, we don't think these employees should be appropriately combined. We think these employees should be separated. We're not sure if the community of interest would be consistent. And so then there would be a hearing process if necessary. The other thing I would say is that currently the law on who is strike prohibited is very, very limited. The only attorneys in the state of Oregon that are currently strike prohibited are deputy district attorneys. And that is based on, and the statutes are very limited. You could look at them. They're ORS 243.736 and ORS 243.738. Primarily, those groups are correctional officers and other public safety entities. There is an Oregon State Bar opinion that says even the Oregon Department of Justice attorneys are in fact allowed to go on strike, based on the theory that as long as your clients are protected, it is acceptable to do so. And that I know that issue has been raised before
this committee.
Exactly.
May I follow up, please?
Follow up.
Thank you. So first of all, just about that, because I seem to recall this committee, we actually, even though the DOJ attorneys were not legally prohibited from doing so by statute, I think the rules of professional conduct, at least some of them felt that it precluded their ability to strike. That is to say, they could legally strike, but then they'd be subject to potentially bar complaint, which was a site. And I don't know how that would intersect with this. Also, can you talk about the PLF at all, to the extent you feel comfortable? Although the bar is coming up behind you if you don't.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Chair Holvey, Representative Barton, absolutely. From mm-hmm. a practical perspective, whether or not an attorney can actually go on strike mm-hmm. is different from whether or not if certain circumstances are met, they can, in fact, go on strike. Mm-hmm. Certainly, I believe AFSCME's position is that that Oregon Department of Justice attorneys should be strike prohibited. Mm-hmm. That hasn't happened just yet. There's some things that have happened in the collective bargaining process.
We passed.
You're not crazy.
Maybe it died in the Senate, like many good bills. Okay.
But so there's that. There's the practical reality and then the legal reality. Nothing in this bill, as we've proposed it, would answer the question either way. We would still have attorneys at the Oregon State Bar, should they choose to organize, that would have to face some of those questions of, can I take care of my client and still go on strike? They would still have those conversations with Oregon State Bar. The Oregon State Bar, during the collective bargaining process, could do what the Department of Justice ultimately did and say, hey, let's carve out a process so that disputes and the bargaining process will go to binding arbitration. With respect to the PLF, I think the best way that I could answer that is to say that Safe Corporation is in fact covered as well by PECBA currently. Now, I don't believe that Safe has yet organized. I know efforts have been made in years past to organize Safe, but I don't see anything in the current law or PECBA that would prevent an insurance professional from becoming organized and exercising the same rights in their employment relationships that anybody else has in the private sector or public sector.
Thank you.
Other questions? I'm curious, are there any federal laws or state laws for that matter that I guess would state that all workers have a right to organize?
Shareholder, members of the committee, there are state laws that indicate that employees have the right to organize, but those laws are with respect to public entities, such as the Oregon State Bar, other state-specific entities. Those are incorporated within PECBA. So if we don't adopt PECBA and make it clear that PECBA applies to the Oregon State Bar, there's no statute that I'm aware of that would specifically say the employees have the right to organize, notwithstanding the absence of the applicability of PECBA, nor would there be a process for the employees to exercise that right, should there be one.
Are there any federal guarantees of that?
The only federal guarantees are with respect to private sector employees under the NLRA.
Agriculture. So, clarify this for me. So, under Oregon statute, public employees are guaranteed a right to organize, and under federal, the NRLA, the private sector employees have the right to organize.
I would say that the word guarantee is the only reason that I'm hesitating, because no employee is guaranteed the right. Certainly, there's lots of bargaining units that have been rejected as inappropriate by both the NLRA and by the ERB. But certainly, the right to organize is just as you described it.
All right. Thank you. Up next, another question.
Just
Fagan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This statement that you can't organize under the NLRA, is that your interpretation of the law? Has that been found by somebody? Is that something the bar is going to agree with? Like, I just find that to be a very, interesting and compelling point on this issue, is if you're not under PECBA, but you're not private under the NLRA. So can you provide me some kind of background authority for why that is the case, or if it's a disputed fact? Or
Chair Holvey, Representative Fagan, my understanding is that it's because of the way that the NLRA is worded. Mm-hmm. It governs private sector relationships. There's no coverage for public sector employees, hence the reason that an employee of the Department of Revenue can't seek redress with the National Labor Relations Board. The statutes are simply not, I think it's a separation of powers issue, a separation of rights, which is why the NLRA is not broad enough. And I don't believe that would be a disputed fact. Or a disputed area of the law.
Okay.
Follow up.
But just to be clear, so it's an interpretation of the law. It's not like there's ever been a court or somebody that has held that. So I'm just trying to get understanding of kind of where that – it's not been attempted and then denied under the NLRA as in terms of they don't have jurisdiction. It's just kind of an interpretation of the statute as it exists.
I don't know that it's ever been tried. It's certainly been a long-established I'm sure that someone at some point may have tried it.
Okay.
There's always precedent for someone trying everything.
Right.
But certainly there's no dispute, as far as I'm aware, in the legal community that the NLRA would extend to public entities.
Thank you.
Other questions? Not seeing any. Thank you very much for your testimony this morning. And up next, Helen. Helen. Good morning, and if you would introduce yourself before your testimony.
Sure. Good morning, and thank you for inviting me. My name is Helen Hirschbiel. I'm general counsel for the Oregon State Bar, and I'm here on behalf of the Oregon State Bar Board of Governors, one, to let you all know that the bar does not oppose this bill, and secondly, to answer any questions that you may have.
Thank you. Representative Barton, go for it.
Do you mind speaking to some of my general issues, please?
I would be happy to.
Welcome to this committee, by the way. She's often in the Judiciary Committee. I think this is the first time we've seen you here.
Thank you. Yes. Chair Holvey and members of the committee, and specifically Representative Barton, just to clarify with respect to who this bill would apply to, it would apply to the employees of the Oregon State Bar, including the employees of the Professional Liability Fund. The Professional Liability Fund is a, we like to call it sort of a subsidiary of the Oregon State Bar, but it is part of the Oregon State Bar, and employees of the Professional Liability Fund are employees of the bar. So, but it would not apply to any other members of the bar. In other words, just being a member of the Oregon State Bar does not, wouldn't give you any of those rights. With respect to Representative Fagan's question about the NLRA, there have been no opinions on this. We've actually looked at it, and it's never been challenged. Nobody's ever tried to collectively bargain that we're aware of, and been denied. We don't know whether the National Labor Relations Act would apply to the bar or not. It is a question of interpretation. The statute applies, the NLRA applies to public entity, or does not apply to public entities. There's a specific exclusion for public entities, and so the question would become whether the Oregon State Bar is considered a public entity, and because the bar has a unique status, we don't know whether it would apply or not.
Thank you. Representative Widener.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm just kind of curious looking at this because I'm trying to figure out why we're doing it. I'm just wondering, did the bar reach out to AFSCME, or did AFSCME reach out to the bar to do this?
Chair Holvey and members of the committee, there was no, the bar did not ask for this. So I believe it was AFSCME that was looking for this, but we were not aware of the AFSCME's or this bill until it became a bill. So in terms of, I'm having trouble with the reaching out part because there wasn't any reaching out.
I was kind of curious. Follow up. Just the origination of it, you know, whether you have members that are looking to start collective bargaining and were denied, or if AFSCME just brought the bill forward themselves.
Not that I am aware of. Not that I'm aware of.
Thank you.
Other questions? So, if this strike prohibitive issue, does the bar really see an issue with potentially part of their people being strike prohibitive or not, or do you think that's an issue at all?
Chair Holvey, we haven't had that much of an opportunity to consider that. I will say that we've thought about how whether the lawyers who are responsible for prosecuting lawyers who have engaged in professional misconduct, in other words, the disciplinary counsel's office lawyers, whether if they went on strike, there would be problems with public protection. In other words, would a lawyer who was stealing money from a client, for example, could we not suspend that lawyer quickly enough because our disciplinary counsel lawyers were on strike? that's, you know, that's crossed our minds that that could be problematic. But we're not at this time asking that there be any exclusion specifically for disciplinary counsel lawyers. I understand that there may, I was not aware of this, that there may be some exclusion for Department of Justice lawyers, and so we would like to be included in that conversation if that goes forward, because that it might be appropriate for disciplinary counsel lawyers as well.
Representative Bart.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My memory has been, my recollection was refreshed. We passed that bill in the House. It stalled in the Senate, but my understanding is that the issue was resolved in their own collective bargaining agreement, essentially.
Okay.
You can bargain
around
through
that.
Binding arbitration process,
okay,
essentially, and take care of the issue that way.
Okay. Thank you.
Any other questions? Go ahead.
May I also? Yes, please. Thank you. Thank you, Chair Holvey. I just also want to clarify on the ethics issue. It is true there's an ethics opinion. It's Ethics Opinion 2005-162, and it does say that...
Off the top of your head.
Came prepared for something. it does say that lawyers who are... lawyers may strike. That's absolutely true. But the lawyers are also going to have to consider in making a decision about whether to strike and planning for a strike their responsibilities under the rules of professional conduct, including not neglecting their cases and communicating with their clients. So arrangements need to be made in some way for taking care of the clients during the strike period.
It looks like you've spurred another question, Representative Nose.
More of a comment, Mr. Chair, if you'll indulge me. It's just that all workers, when they contemplate going on strike, particularly in the public sector, have that responsibility. And that, in part, that's why there's a mediation process, and in part why there's a notice that has to be given, so that there's an opportunity for the parties to try to work things out before that step is taken. So all professions, teachers, all.
And your question is whether she agrees with that?
He just said he was making a statement.
He did flag it as a comment.
Other questions, comments today? Not seeing any. I appreciate you helping us understand this issue, and appreciate your testimony.
Thank you very much for the opportunity.
Was there anyone else that wanted to testify on House Bill 2565? Not seeing any. With that, I will close public hearing on House Bill 2565. Committee, we do have a big schedule on Friday, a lot of bills to look at and vote on, so hopefully you're prepared to vote when you come in on Friday.
Mr. Chair, I volunteer Friday to have Representative Evans carry all the bills that we do. It's his turn, because he kept pointing towards me.
Yeah. We'll take that under consideration.
I'm going to assign them all to Representative Clem.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Since he is there.
I like it.
And as well, on Monday, don't forget that we do have a Monday evening meeting, public hearing, a joint public hearing on minimum wage.
We also have one that morning also.
And we have the informational meeting that morning.
Okay, thank you.
So with that, I will adjourn the House Committee on Business and Labor.
2 hours.
Business and Labor.
2 hours.